rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. No person shall be held to answer for a capital or otherwise infamous crime. I'm sharing with you the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution of the United States. Unless on a presentment or indictment of a grand jury, except in cases arising in the land or naval forces or in the militia, when in actual service in time of war or public danger, nor shall any person be subject for the same offense to twice be put in jeopardy of limb or life. Nor shall he be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself, nor be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. But there's that little paragraph in there. Nor shall any person be subject for the same offense to be twice put in jeopardy of life or limb. In other words, you can't try a person twice for the same crime. Sounds pretty straightforward. Sounds like it makes sense. Peter DeMott has had a bit of a different experience. Hey, Peter, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Peter, tell us what happened. Let's just start out here back in March 17th, 2003.
Well, on that date, which is to say St. Patrick's Day, 2 days before the United States launched an illegal war, an aggressive war of invasion against Iraq, myself and three other friends went to our local Army and Marine Corps recruiting station here in the Ithaca, New York area, and we brought a small quantity of our own blood with us, which we poured in the lobby, on the walls, on the windows, on the floor, on some recruiting literature, and we also got a little blood on the American flag. And then we knelt down and we prayed that the war might be averted, that our leadership might come to its senses, and that we might turn away from the bloodbath that we knew was going to follow. We did spill some of our blood in the lobby there of the recruiting station, but we thought that this small amount of blood that we put there was nothing, absolutely nothing, compared to the bloodbath that would inevitably follow. And we knelt, we prayed. We were there but a few minutes when the recruiters came from their offices out into the lobby, saw what had happened, and quickly called the police. At that point, we were taken away. We spent about 4 days in jail, and then we were given a trial date. And eventually, we went to trial in April of 04, a little over a year later, in our local New York State Tompkins County Court, and we were charged with a felony count of criminal mischief. And after about a 3 day or 4 day trial, the jury came back with a verdict 9-3 in our favor, which is to say, 9 of them thought that what we had done was entirely appropriate. They too realized the illegality and immorality of this war and were right there with us in complete solidarity with us. 3 of them, however, held out and wanted a conviction. So after 20 hours of deliberation, the whole thing ended in a mistrial. That was in April of 04. And in February of this year, we got a knock on the door. The FBI showed up with a summons telling us that we had to appear in the federal court in Binghamton, New York. In other words, the whole case was being tried all over again, this time on federal charges. This time it's 3 charges. 1 charge, a felony count of conspiracy, and then 3 misdemeanor charges. And we have to go to court on the 19th of September. Just a month from now, 4 weeks from today, actually, and we will be facing up to 6 years in federal prison and $250,000 in fines. And we're all family people. We all have children, all 4 of us, and we're not relishing the prospect of going to jail, but we're less enthused about the prospect of this war continuing and going on and claiming more and more lives all the time. And instead of diminishing the amount of terror in the world, we are, in my opinion, creating more and more terrorists all the time by our criminal activity in Iraq.
We're talking with Peter DeMott, one of the St. Pat 4, St. Patrick 4, you've been labeled, I guess.
Well, because the action took place on St. Patrick's Day.
Yeah. Now, the news story that I have in front of me says four Catholic workers from Ithaca, New York.
Right.
What does that
mean?
Well,
the Catholic worker was a movement founded in New York City in the 30s during the Depression by a woman named Dorothy Day and her friend, a Frenchman named Peter Morin. And what they were trying to do was address the crisis of brought on by the Depression, the homelessness, hunger, poverty, unemployment, and they opened a house of hospitality. They were taking homeless people. They opened soup kitchens where they were trying to feed hungry people. And it's a movement that's started in the early 30s, but now it's international now. It's spread all over the country and the world. And there are different houses of hospitality in different various cities, but going with that is a social or a political analysis of what is it that causes the hunger, the unemployment, the poverty in the first place. And in our view, a lot of it is because of the misappropriation of funds by the military. You know, if we lived in a society where war was not the number one priority, then we wouldn't have homelessness and poverty and unemployment.
So, Peter DeMott, you're motivated in this, I take it, by your Catholic faith?
That's correct, yes. And also by, I'm a Vietnam veteran, too. I was in the Marine Corps in Vietnam in 1969. I'm also a veteran of the Army. I spent about 2 years and 9 months in the Marine Corps, got out for a year, but then joined the Army to go to the language school in Monterey, California. So I have about 4.5 years in the Army and a little under 3 years in the Marine Corps. So I'm a veteran, Vietnam veteran, and speak from a personal history of having been to Vietnam and knowing that war only makes matters worse.
So let me get this straight. Peter DeMott, you and your three colleagues who poured this blood in the Marine recruiting office did so knowing that you could go to prison and being willing to go to prison to do it. Is that correct?
Well, that's correct. But we, I think, uppermost in our minds was the illegality of the war and our sense of a moral obligation to speak out against the loss of innocent life. You know, we're up to about 2,000 American service personnel that have died over there right now, and estimates of as high as 100,000 Iraqi civilians. And of that number, probably 75% of them are innocent children and women and non-combatants, and that is just it's just an abomination that's part of this war, but that's the reality. And we knew that would happen. That's what happened in Vietnam. We lost 58,000 American service personnel there, but upwards of 2 million Vietnamese, and of that number, you know, again, the figures are 75 to 80% of them are non-combatants, children, women, elderly people, just are in the wrong place at the wrong time. But that's the character of modern war. And we knew that was going to happen, and so we felt a sense of a moral obligation to speak out against this innocent loss of life, the shedding of precious human blood. And so we poured a very small quantity of our own blood to dramatize that, and we thought that this was something that we really felt we could not do. So that's what we did.
You felt that you had to do it.
That's right.
We're talking with Peter DeMott, one of four Catholic workers from Ithaca, New York, who the St. Patrick Four, who confronted the machine, as it were. And, Patrick, we have a caller who says she disagrees with you. You mind taking a call?
Not at all, sure.
Bridget in Chesapeake, Virginia, you're live with Peter
DeMott.
Good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen. In the year 2002, when the first grumbling started about going to war, I started speaking up. In January, it was raining cats and dogs in Norfolk, and I went down there and put on my boots because I was so against the war. I'm still against the war. But I completely disagree when you spilled your blood. I mean, first of all, I'm kind of like paranoid with AIDS and everything and blood and human, you know, stuff. I mean, I support you, you know, the march in Washington when we had the signs calling talk show hosts. You have no idea the name I've been called down here, and they want to send me back to Switzerland where I come from. So I'm 100%. I was against the war when it was not even cool to be, but no, I think you were totally wrong spilling your blood. Why did you feel the need you had to do that?
Well, I think we use the symbol of blood to dramatize the issue, to make people realize that war is a very, very bloody and nasty and dirty and distasteful event, and we need to take that home and to make that graphically palpable and appreciate that on a really on a gut level. And I think that the blood help people to do that.
I think I disagree with you, because I think people like myself who are fiery protesters were and still are, but the thought, I mean, it never crossed to us to you know, take blood and spill blood. I mean, there are so many...
you draw the line at that, in other words, Bridget. Okay,
I
got that. Peter, thank you for calling, Bridget. I appreciate it. Peter, I'm wondering if any of you, you know, bothered to find out if you had any diseases that could be communicated by blood.
Yes, we had our blood tested. None of us has tested positive for anything contagious or anything like that. So it wasn't a health issue.
So there was no AIDS, no hepatitis, that kind of thing?
No.
Yeah, well, you're fortunate, I guess, as well. Where does, first of all, is there a website for your group?
Yes, there is. It's www.stpatricksfour.org, and it's STPATRICKSFOUR. There's no apostrophe there, so it's www.stpatricksfour.
Now, and the headline at that website says, "The first and only federal conspiracy trial arising out of civil resistance to the Iraq War begins September 19th in Binghamton, New York."
That's correct.
What are you looking for from people who might read your website? Do you need support?
Well, yeah, we would appreciate any kind of support, you know, moral or spiritual or you know, financial. You know, this is all we're all the principal means of support for our families. We're breadwinners, and if people can come to the trial, we hope to have people. Just to show up in support of us, and then simultaneously with the trial in the evening after the court proceedings are done, we hope to put the war on trial. We're going to be having a speak out or a citizens tribunal on the war in Iraq, and hope to be bringing in speakers to address the issues surrounding the war. It's illegality, for instance. Ray McGovern, a former CIA analyst that knew all along about the phony information that was being put out about the weapons of mass destruction and you know, the various justification for it. We're also hoping to bring in service people, possibly from the New York State National Guard. These would be men who were there in Iraq and served their time there, and then have come back now, and they're contaminated with depleted uranium. Some of them have fathered children that are being, you know, have come up with birth defects and deformities. Hello.
Yeah. We have to go to a break. I'm sorry, but Peter DeMott, thanks for being with us today. I appreciate the great work you're doing.
Surely. Okay. Thank you very much.
STPatricksFOUR.org. STPatricksFOUR.org. The website for more information. Peter DeMott. This is the Tom Hartman Radio Program. 20 minutes past the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
There's something wrong with the world today. I don't know what it is. Something's wrong with our eyes.
And welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you. 24 and a half minutes past the hour, to be precise. And, you know, what are the appropriate boundaries of protest? It raises an interesting question. You can imagine where if somebody, you know, if you were working in the Marine recruiting office and you came out and you saw blood all over the place, you might think, geez, somebody's been in here with, you know, with a knife killing somebody. But then on the other hand, you see four guys sitting on the floor praying, and I think you'd get it fairly quickly. But blood is something that really scares us. On the other hand, you know, one of the reasons why they call the Humvees vehicles that are not designed for combat, vehicles that were designed for military police use. One of the reasons that they call Humvees watermelons is because they're painted green on the outside, and so very tragically often in Iraq, they get splattered with blood on the inside. And so, you know, it's what are the appropriate boundaries? Where do you draw the line? What is appropriate? What should be legal? What should be illegal? Clearly, I mean, these guys went in knowing what they were doing was illegal. It was an act of vandalism, if nothing else, and they were willing to suffer the consequences. So, anyhow, stpatricksfour.org. You can let them know what you think. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894, toll free, all across the United States. Outside the United States, 503-248-0620. TomHartmann.com is our website. If you want to drop into our live chat room, simply click live chat up at the very top of the page, and it'll take you there. Jeff in Atlanta is on the line. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hey, I heard you talk the other day about how Bush said during the campaign that he's an oil man so he could take care of any oil issues. And now, of course, it's not the case. And you specifically mentioned how the oil companies are actually price gouging us above and beyond the actual price they're paying in excess of the general price of oil, the barrel of oil.
Mm-hmm.
But yesterday, Robert Rice on the one of the talk shows, he was asked about that, and I've heard him talk before, and he seems like he knows what he's talking about and someone you can trust. But he said it's really just a matter of supply and demand and nothing more than that. What would you say to that?
Well, there's two different issues here. If he was asked about the price of oil, then he's right. It is supply and demand. If he was asked about the price of gasoline, it's not...
Well, he was asked about the price of gasoline and what the government might be able to do about it.
Yeah, well, you know, I not having heard the discussion, I really can't comment on it, but I can tell you my knowledge and thoughts and whatever, you know, on this issue. And by the way, my source for this was an article on the front page of the Wall Street Journal that I shared with my listeners here maybe 2-3 months ago when it was published, in which they actually went into the oil company's records, which are by most, you know, a lot of the stuff is public records because these are publicly traded companies. And they found that as the price of oil went up, some of the profits of the oil companies increased because some of the oil companies actually own some of the oil that they're pumping. So the oil that they're pumping becomes more valuable. So as they sell it, whether they sell it to themselves or to whomever they may sell it, they make more profit. But the vast majority of the profit that we're seeing, and the oil companies right now, by the way, are at an all-time high in terms of profitability. I mean, literally an all-time record, going all the way back to 1867 when Colonel Drake drilled the first oil well in Titusville, Pennsylvania, through the robber baron era, through John Rockefeller and the Standard Oil Trust, the whole thing. They are at the highest point of profitability in the history of the industry just in the last 2 years. And it is almost all as a consequence of their having increased the price of gasoline. So when the cost of a barrel, you know, a barrel of oil is 50-some-odd gallons of oil. So, you know, if oil is... $20 a barrel, and it goes to $60 a barrel, you've got a threefold increase in the price of the raw material. But that raw material started out at $18 for 50. That's what, 30 cents a gallon? And that becomes a gallon of gasoline, more or less. And that gallon of gasoline was selling for $1.50. That 30-cent cost now becomes a 40-cent, 50-cent, 60-cent, 70, 80-cent cost. The price of gasoline hasn't gone up to 30 or 40 or 50 cents that you would expect to see as a consequence of that 30 or 40 or 50 cent price increase at the level of crude. It's gone up $1, $1.50, $2. And so not $2, but so anyhow, the point is that the oil companies are jacking up the price of gasoline more than simply the increase in the price of oil would justify.
And Bush could do what about that?
Well, that's a whole other argument. You know, I mean, that's a whole other discussion. I'll share some thoughts with you on that when we come back from this break, Jeff. I appreciate the question. You know, we do have the tyranny of the clock, as it were, here. I will comment on that right after this. It's 29 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartmann.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Don't think of buying from Canada. Oh, we will not play nice. We wrote for new legislation forcing the nation to pay the top price. Oh, Grandma, sign the paper. Grandpa, don't be slow. Yes, you get medication. If you join our HMO, there's no more Medicare. Oh, you'll just have to trust us while we're making Medicare go bust.
And welcome back, my friends. 27 minutes before the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. 1995 through 2000, the profits of the large domestic oil companies, this from consumersunion.org, were relatively stable in the neighborhood of $15 billion per year. Then in 2003, they jumped up to $20 billion per year. Then 2004, up to $25 billion per year. And they've been going up ever since then. I'm just looking on the Consumer Union website here. Pretty straightforward process. And this is where it gets complex, is do you want the gas companies and the oil companies to be making huge profits as a result of the peak oil situation, the fact that oil is getting more and more scarce, and the fact that they have essentially a natural monopoly. There's a small number of very large companies that control the supply of gasoline to the United States. Or do you think that we should have some sort of a reasonable energy policy where some of those revenues end up with we the people, and that there is some benefit to be coming back to the people? If, for example, we've talked about this before, in Europe, they looked at this situation 40 years ago, 50 years ago, and they said, Germany, for example, we don't have any oil, right? A lot of the European countries have very little oil. What are we going to do about this? And so they did two things. They put a lot of money into infrastructure for transportation so that people didn't need a lot of oil to get around, so that they could move from place to place with public transportation. They could, they have trolleys, trains, subways, buses that are very efficient. You can get from pretty much anywhere to anywhere in Europe without ever owning a car or using a car. And then once that was in place, and a lot of it had been in place for a long time, so it wasn't, a Marshall Project. Actually, the Marshall Project was very involved in rebuilding that infrastructure. But it wasn't as huge a job as it might be here in the United States. But in any case, and then they said, okay, and now to discourage the use of petroleum in cars, because this is a resource we want to use for other things, where it's more important, making plastics, making medicine, making food, whatever, we're going to increase the tax on gasoline by $4, $3 to $4 a gallon. So, people in Europe are paying $5 and $6 a gallon for gas and have been for a long, long time. And they've adjusted. They've changed to it. Now, I'm not saying that the price of gas should go to $6 a barrel tomorrow. I mean, that would be nuts. And what's happened right now is because we have no planning here in the United States, because we haven't planned for alternative energy sources, because we haven't brought online anything other than oil, because the government has been dragging their feet for 20 years on corporate average efficiency, fuel efficiency standards, the CAFE standards that all the auto companies have to cleave to, that they have to make sure that all of their cars hit a certain average, because we've exempted from those CAFE standards light trucks. We are actually, our average gas mileage now is below what it was in 1980. So we're just burning incredible amounts of this stuff. So, of course, if you've got people who've, you got a bunch of hooked people and you're a pusher and you start raising the price, what are they going to do? They're hooked. And so the oil companies know they've got us by the neck. And they're just taking full advantage of it. They are wringing as much profit out of us as they can. I'm, very simple. That's the bottom line. Jeff in Manassas, Virginia on the line. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. If you look at the last 5 years, the euro has gained 50% in value against the dollar. Most
right.
foreign currencies have gained 25%. The problem is worldwide.
And the price of gold has just about doubled, too.
The price of oil in the world is based on U.S. dollars. If the dollar is weak, the Saudis and the OPEC's going to raise the price to get a return on their investment on the foreign market. The Bush's deficit spending is what's causing oil prices to be high. When the dollar was strong in the 90s, what was the price of gas?
Yeah, the price of gas was low, and oil was selling for $16, $18 a barrel. You're absolutely right, Jeff. You're absolutely right. And this is one of the key points that I keep coming back to here, is what we're looking at is the consequence of not just a very recent policy, but a 25 years, really, of insane conservative economic policies, both with regard to domestic spending, starting out with Ronald Reagan, Dick Cheney saying, Ronald Reagan taught us deficits don't matter. Well, they do matter. And what's happening is the world is losing confidence in the American dollar. And you could argue, and I think cogently, that the price of oil actually hasn't gone up at all. What's happened is that the value of the dollar has gone down. We've seen oil go, we've seen gold go from $230 an ounce to about $450 an ounce in the last, what, half a dozen years or so. We've seen oil, you know, triple in price. We've seen, as you point out, the euro is up. I thought it was up around 38%. I'm not sure that it's gone as high as 50, but, you know, something like that. The Japanese bank has been selling yen just like crazy to try and keep the yen low because they don't want to harm their exports. But still, the yen is putting pressure on the dollar. Now the yuan is going to rise against the dollar. Basically, what's happened is 25 years of conservative economic policies have bankrupted this nation. We are right now, we're at a position where our debt at $10.1 trillion, which is what we'll be at the end of the Bush presidency, if everything just stays on track, at $10.1 billion, we will be at 70% of GDP. I mean, you know, imagine if what you owed every year was equal to 70% of your income. I mean, you'd be busted. And that's what these guys have brought us. Jeff, thanks for calling and pointing that out. I appreciate it. It's a good one. Good one. Bill in Salt Lake City, Utah on the line. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Yeah, I was wondering, when we get our natural gas fuel for heating.
Yes, sir.
Being a regulated industry, I'm pretty sure that any time the cost of the input increases, that they have a mechanism that part gets passed on through to the consumer.
That's right.
And I was wondering, not that I'm for regulation, but could anything like that be applied for the gas situation?
Well, that's the advantage of a regulated industry. The advantage of a regulated industry in a natural monopoly, and this is historically the way, for example, electric companies ran in the United States. It's why when you play Monopoly, you know, the utilities, they always pay $200 every time you go around. No more, no less. You know, it's a small amount that steadily comes in, and people would invest in utility companies knowing that they would get a dividend every year and pretty much knowing in advance, you know, for the next 15 years, this is what it's going to be. They're never going to get rich. They're never going to go broke. There's no risk. And the reason why is because just exactly what you said. What we say to them is you can be a private for-profit corporation, but you're going to be very heavily regulated. So we're going to make sure that you make a profit, but we're not going to allow you to make an obscene profit. It's the same way, by the way, that the airlines were operating right up until 1982 when they deregulated the airline industry. And the airline industry was doing very well up until deregulation. And then there was this explosion, and, you know, as you see with generally an unregulated industry, and now the shakeout is happening, or over the last 10 years, I would argue, the shakeout has been happening. And certainly the travel industry as a whole, all the travel agencies experienced their shakeout first in the early 90s.
Yeah.
And so anyhow, that's what happens. But the problem is that to regulate the gasoline industry right now is going to be impossible. There's too much money and too much power in the hands of the oil industry right now for there to be any successful effort at regulation. It's just a political impossibility, no matter how much sense it might make.
Too hard to go backwards.
Yeah. Well, okay. Or go forwards.
Right. I got you. Okay.
You know, they're just. I mean, they've got enough money. You think the Harry and Louise ads that prevented us from having national health care were a big deal? I mean, you know, that the health care industry's got a lot of cash, but it's nothing compared to what the oil industry's got.
All right. Okay.
So now the president's coming to visit Salt Lake City, there, Bill, where you are. I'm curious what's going to happen.
Well, I know they're he's coming to speak to I don't know if it's Veterans of Foreign Wars, but some veterans group that's meeting here, and I know one thing that was a bit unusual is the mayor of Salt Lake City, who is a Democrat, had actually sent out an email to different activist groups to make sure to get a bunch of people over there, so when Bush comes, he's met with some resistance in the reddest of the red states, which I thought was unique.
That's pretty impressive. Are they going to put him in a free speech zone, surround him with barbed wire, and point guns at him?
That I don't know. I don't think it's happened yet. I worked a little later last night, and I haven't bounced up yet. But I want to drive down there. And I also know there was some TV ad spot that they refused to air up here, the Cindy Sheehan.
Yes.
Like 1 minute spot.
Yes.
And I did hear about that as well. So. Those are the two things I know, and other than it's going to tie up a lot of traffic, but
yeah.
That's usual.
Okay.
So.
All righty, great. Well, thank you very much, Bill. I appreciate the call, and thanks for the information. Here, by the way, just FYI, is the Cindy Sheehan ad that they are refusing to air in Salt Lake City, Utah. What the television stations are refusing to air, the TV part of it, the visual, is a close-up shot of Cindy Sheehan's head, and she's looking right into the camera. It's just her head, just her face looking at the camera, speaking very directly.
Mr. President, my name is Cindy Sheehan. On April 4, 2004, my son Casey was killed in Iraq. He was only 24, and he died in his best friend's arms. Casey was so good and so honest. Why can't you be honest with us? You were wrong about the weapons of mass destruction. You were wrong about the link between Iraq and Al-Qaeda. You lied to us. And because of your lies, my son died. You said he died for a noble cause. What cause? Mr. President, I want to tell you face to face how much this hurts. I love my country, but how many more of our loved ones need to die in this senseless war? How many more soldiers have to die before we say enough? I know you can't bring Casey back, but it's time to admit mistakes and bring our troops home now.
That's Cindy Sheehan and the ad that will not play in Salt Lake City when the president arrives, although it is playing in Crawford, Texas. They have succeeded in buying time on the local system, on the local station there. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Bob in Indianapolis, Indiana on the line. Hey, Bob.
Hi, Tom. How are you today?
I am great, but I'll get better. What's up, Bob?
That's good. Wanted to say a couple things, ask you a question or two. Number one, at the price of oil at $65 a barrel on the world market, there's only 35 gallons in a barrel of oil when you buy a barrel.
Right. I'm just looking at some information here. Scott has updated me. 42 gallons of crude in a barrel, and it refines out to about 35 gallons, right?
Which is about $1.85 for the feedstock. So anyway, defending the oil companies because I don't think they're doing us right, but the price is kind of following. If you do the ratios, they're fairly similar.
So the ratios are increasing, and therefore the profit is increasing.
Right.
Yeah.
The net profit is going up dramatically. The ratio of profit's not going up all that much. But anyway, I'm not defending the oil companies.
Yeah, interesting.
Last week you'd said something about George Bush was running around the White House swearing like Nixon and all that stuff.
I said that that had been reported on a website called Capitol Hill Blue.
Okay.
And the caveat I put out before I said that was this is a website that's sort of like the National Enquirer. It's sort of like the National Enquirer of White House or of Washington D.C. reporting sites. They always go for the sensational stuff, and every now and then they just nail it right spot on. But it's 6 months later that you find out about it. And so, you know, with that caveat, this is, you know, it's rare that I do National Enquirer type stories. And in fact, I think it's probably been a year since I've used a story from Capitol Hill Blue.
I was just kind of interested where you'd heard it from, and I did not hear your caveat. And the third thing I want to say was you'd recommended on BuzzFlash the Batra book about Greenspan's fraud. That's an excellent book, and all your listeners should read that.
Yeah, I agree.
Economics.
Yeah, we've had Ravi Batra on the program, in fact. His book is called Greenspan's Fraud, and it is not only a brilliant overview of macroeconomics, you know, just understanding the big picture of how economics works between nations and within the nation, but it's also a marvelous expose of the fraud perpetrated on the United States by Ronald Reagan and Alan Greenspan, and that Greenspan has been continuing all these years, particularly with regard to Social Security. Bob, thanks a lot for the call.
Thank you.
Great to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania on the line. Hey, Gary, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I did hear you preface that remark.
Yeah, well, I did. So
I heard it.
Yeah, thank you.
You're honest. That's what impresses me the most.
Well, I do.
That's what impresses me the most. You could be a Republican, and I would say the same thing.
Well, you know, I got to say, Gary, in part, it's because I'm lazy. I discovered very early on in my life that it's a whole heck of a lot easier to remember the truth than to try and remember lies. Maybe it's because I have ADD or something. I can't remember lies. So, you know, it's just easier to tell the truth.
I just thought I'd throw it. Very good. Thanks for Tom Hartman, by the way.
Sure. Did you have a question?
I just thought about the honesty part, and it stopped me in my tracks.
Okay.
Pardon me. Not only is America, in my view, the last, it's not my view, it's somebody else's, the last best hope of mankind. We've heard that before, right?
Yeah.
I just seem to strike me through the years. America is, and maybe this is the same vein, America is the last best financial hope of mankind. Could that possibly be true?
Well, it could be. I mean, you know, it certainly was from the period of the 1940 through 1980.
And leadership starts
at
the top.
But we've reversed. I mean, you know, in 1980, we were the world's largest creditor. We were a fully developed first world nation. Our exports of finished goods were very, very high. Our imports were primarily of raw materials, which, you know, is you see with fully developed industrialized nations. On the other hand, now, after 25 years of conservative economics and trade policy, we are principally an importer of finished goods, and our primary exports are raw materials, lumber, corn, paper, used cardboard boxes, oddly enough, one of our major exports, stuff like that. Yeah.
Does this kind of make sense to anybody out there? I don't want it to be too deep. I'm just a very simple man, believe it or not. I'm just an average American who's concerned with this country. That we have in our culture, we lack tremendously, in my judgment, what I coined financial humility.
Financial humility.
Humility. We have no humility when it comes to...
Finish your sentence.
We have no humility when it comes to the divisions between the rich and the poor.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think part of the problem, Gary, and thank you for your call. We've got to take a break here, but well said. I think part of the problem is that we have no education about economics. I mean, there are a lot of things that were just given and assumed and well known in the 30s that aren't any longer. I'll fill some of those in for you right after the...
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 5 minutes before the hour. 1-866-888-889-8894, our telephone number. Just very quickly, Teddy Roosevelt. Talking about, you know, what people knew about economics in the first half of the 20th century. Here's Teddy Roosevelt introducing the phrase living wage, not minimum wage, living wage, into the lexicon, a recording made by Thomas Edison himself. Teddy Roosevelt in 1913 talking about the living wage.
We stand for a living wage. Wages are subnormal if they fail to provide a living for those who devote their time and energy to industrial occupation. The monetary equivalent of a living wage varies according to local conditions.
And then he gets into and he says, okay, here's what makes up a living wage. Here are the criteria. Here's how you know that it's actually a living wage.
But must include enough to secure the elements of a normal standard of living. A standard high enough to make morality possible.
Make morality possible. In other words, you don't have to steal to get food.
To provide for education and recreation.
Education and recreation. You can put your kids through school. You can take a vacation every year.
To care for immature members of the family.
You can raise your children.
To maintain the family during periods of sickness.
Ah, you have health care.
And to permit a reasonable saving for old age.
And to permit a reasonable saving for old age. Teddy Roosevelt, 1913. Everybody used to understand that's what an economy is all about. An economy is all about making sure that, you know, if you play by the rules and you work hard all your life, then you know that you can raise a family by the standards that Teddy Roosevelt was talking about. Joseph in Wells, Vermont on the line. Hey, Joseph, what's up?
Hey, pretty good. How about you?
Great. We got about a half a minute here, Joseph.
Okay, listen, I'm trying to buy a new car, and I sent an email to the Mercedes dealers in Montreal. I said, look, I want a smart car, 60 miles to the gallon gas, 80 to the diesel. I can't buy one as an American. I have to have a Canadian address and a Canadian residency. What the hell is it with this NAFTA crap?
Would you ask
Bernie that Friday, please?
Well, no, but you may. You're certainly welcome to call him and ask him. Yeah, if I remember, I can't make a commitment to it, but I'll try to remember to ask him. You know, what's going on? Why can't Joseph buy a smart car in Canada? It's an interesting question. Smart car. I need to look into that. Joseph, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. So, an economy, just the broad concept has been done away with. 20 years of conservative economics now, and people think that if you work hard all your life, you maybe shouldn't be entitled to actually be able to raise a family. That the purpose of an economy is not to support the people in it, but rather just to support the CEO class, the Ken Lays among us. You know, isn't it tragic how much things have changed? But that's, you know, what the Heritage Foundation's out there for.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from California to Pennsylvania, streaming down from outer space on Sirius Satellite Radio, beaming around the planet on WhiteRoseSociety.org, RadioPower.org, podcasting at Apple's iTunes. Welcome back to our program. Our toll-free number all across the United States, 1-866-889-8894. From outside the United States, 503-248-0620. And you can drop into our live chat room at tomhartman.com. Lynn Braddock is with us. Let's check in and find out what's going on at Camp Casey there in Texas. Lynn is a Gold Star mother. Her son died in Karbala, I believe it was, Lynn.
That's correct. Karbala, yeah. Iraq.
Yes. And your son's name was...
Travis John Braddock Knoll.
Yes. And you know, as a parent, it is hard to, it's not even hard, it goes beyond hard to imagine what it must be like for you. It is an imagination that I think most parents don't even allow themselves to visit. And I don't want to bring up all the bad stuff all over again, but I wanted to honor you for what you've gone through and your son's service to this country and for having the courage to head down to Crawford, Texas and take on the machine there.
Thank you.
So what's going on in Camp Casey today?
Well, okay, so I'm up at the second tent right now. I'd say it's just kind of like every day begins. It's very quiet. People are starting to filter in. The ones with tables and information-type booths are setting up. So we're just getting started. It's like this every day, and you kind of think, oh, I guess the crowd won't be so big. And, like, for example, yesterday I'd say easily, oh, my gosh, at one point there had to be easily 600 people. So I can't imagine, because people come and go, families come and go. I mean, the crowd just swells and ebbs as time, you know, as the day peaks up and goes out. It's really phenomenal. Maybe you've already heard that Joan Baez joined us yesterday.
Yes.
And gave us a concert, and, you know, when you called, I was just at the little mother's table, just having a little, we're all sitting around chatting with her. She wanted to stay another day. She just said, hey, this is where I want to be. And it is, once you get here, this is, for so many people, this is the way, this is the place they want to be. So many are coming for it, like, I've never done anything like this before. I needed to see this. It's awesome, Tom. It's just awesome.
I'm surprised, Lynn Braddock, that if George Bush's home is close enough to this camp that he could have heard, for example, Joan Baez's concert, that they haven't shut you guys down on some sort of noise ordinance. I mean, if I play stereo really loud, my neighbors can have me, you know, can send the police over to my house to knock on the door. Do you think that they're being very tolerant just because they don't want the bad press, or is it that you guys aren't trying to provoke them, or what?
We're not trying to provoke them. We're not trying to provoke them, but I definitely would say they're being very tolerant, because we are. It is such a peaceful movement. The people here are so gracious, and it is such a spiritual movement, so intense on why we feel this way, but very much we're keeping no friction, no yelling,
yeah,
no ugly things, not a word to be said about our troops. We're proud of our troops.
Mm.
So I don't think they would dare to shut us down. Believe me, we're playing the stereo loud. We do sing-alongs where we were shouting bushwhacked. So if it was a noise factor, I think they'd go after us.
Mm. I think that George W. doesn't want to repeat the mistake that Herbert Hoover, the last president to lose so many jobs on his administration as George W. has lost, that Herbert Hoover made when the bonus army formed, when the World War I veterans who wanted their bonus pay for having served in war, paid a little early because of the Great Depression, camped out outside the White House, you know, and all the way down along the, I believe it was the Delaware River there. And Herbert Hoover sent, MacArthur and Eisenhower on horseback along with, you know, a bunch of soldiers. Yeah, busted them up, set their little camp on fire and all that sort of thing. And that was, you know, really bad press. It was a big mistake PR-wise, and so Bush apparently isn't going to duplicate that. But you know, he must just be, well, he's heading out of town now, isn't he?
Exactly, and the thing is, he's headed out of town, but there will be people to meet him. There are more Gold Star families that'll be waiting each stop along the way
in Idaho and Salt Lake City. And,
exactly, you know. In Idaho and Salt Lake City. At this point, you can't believe how strong we're getting. I was not a mother. I have always been against the war. I've always been able to do a one-on-one interview, but every time I cry, and I just for some reason felt I wanted to be stronger than that. I didn't want to cry, and now I realize I want people to see me cry. I don't want anyone to imagine. You can't imagine. Don't imagine, because it's so frightening to imagine what I'm going through. Mm-hmm. But I guess I do. I want them to know how much pain this is bringing for lies. And so there's so many of us who, you know, Cindy brought us out. Cindy has helped to make us strong, and binding together has made us strong, and we're not. This will not stop. This is not going to end. We're going to just push and push and push until we get the troops. We begin to pull out.
Yeah. Yeah, and here's the ironic kind of catch-22, Lynn. If George Bush declares victory and brings the troops home within the next, well, if he waits, you know, 4 or 5, 6 months to do it, and he does it right after the first of next year, then that will probably be the very best thing he could do politically for the Republicans in the elections of November of 2006.
Exactly. I suppose politically it would be one of the best things. One thing I will always do is be politically active. So I constantly am in people's faces going, okay, folks, let's look at the track record here.
Yeah.
I mean, it's because so many people didn't pay attention. I'll admit, I didn't really pay that much attention. I wasn't out there campaigning. I simply marked my ballot. But that will not happen again. And I think a lot of the Gold Star families weren't. Well, a lot of them were. I will admit there's some amazing people here who have traveled extensively. I would say intellectually our group is phenomenal, if you want to know the truth.
Mm-hmm.
But I was one of the little steps aside, just do your little deal, and that will no longer happen. Politically, yes, it would be very powerful for him, but also politically I think this is very powerful for us, because it will constantly, that will be why my son died, to constantly stay in people's faces to say, look what our country was able to do. Look why I lost my son. Don't let this happen again. Don't let them take control.
Yes, let us take our country back. Let's make this the kind of country that it can and should become. Yeah.
And we can take our country back. That's what, when you get to a real low, no. This country still belongs to the people. Don't just sit back and say, oh, woe with us. That is not going to help us. We need each and every one of you.
Yeah, well said. Well said, Lynn Braddock. And Lynn, where do you, you know, Bush is going to Washington, D.C. when he finishes his vacation, presumably. Now, you know, back on August 6th of 2001, when he was given the memo that said that bin Laden was about to strike in the United States,
oh, yeah.
He extended his vacation so that he wouldn't be in Washington, D.C. And then when bin Laden still hadn't struck, when September came, he still was afraid to go up to Washington, D.C. because he apparently knew that there was a bullseye there. And so he went down to Florida, where his brother was. But presumably now he hasn't gotten a memo like that this week, and so he plans to go back to Washington, D.C. What are the Gold Star families and the other groups that are mobilizing around this war going to do when he goes to Washington, D.C.?
I was going to say, has he gotten a memo that we're coming to visit?
Anything's possible.
As far as I know, they're all of us, the ones that weren't even headed up there, were going, have you made your reservations yet? Are you going to be up there on the 24th? And you just can't be. The ones that weren't going are like, oh, my gosh. I mean, one woman is thinking of canceling a trip to Kenya, which she cannot do.
Yeah.
He's not going to get away, like I said, Tom. I'm sorry. If he goes to Florida, shoot, I've got a son going to college down there. I'll just hightail it down there.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of us have given up a lot. And one thing I want people to know, if they're saying who's financing it, a lot of this is being financed by us.
Mm-hmm.
Me, personally, I feel so passionately about this that that I shall probably get a memo. He's going to have a lot of company in Washington.
Yeah, well, good. Good. It's so important in a democracy for us to hold our leaders accountable, or our representatives. I mean,
exactly.
It's interesting. There's a woman here in Oregon, in Portland, who was telling me that Marsha Myers is very active in local progressive politics. Who we had lunch with a couple days ago, and she said that she's on a campaign now to purge the word leader from our vocabulary and replace it with the word representative, because we live in a representative democracy and we don't elect leaders. We elect representatives. We elect people to represent us. And the president's job is not to be the leader of the United States. It doesn't say that in the Constitution. The president's job is to represent the United States, to be doing the will of the people, not to tell the people that they're going to do his will. So,
you know what? I absolutely love that. So when I get back home, I hope I'll be able to meet her, because that's what I have said over and over. Excuse me, this man is a president. We elected him.
Yeah.
He's supposed to represent the people.
Yes.
You know, where did this guy get... Well, he always had that mindset that he has, obviously. Where did we get the idea to put him in?
Yeah.
So, but everybody goes, it wasn't me. And I'm like, you know what? We're all to blame. We're all to blame in many, many ways. So.
Well, to the extent that we're not standing up and speaking out. I mean, we all have, I mean, that's the obligation in a representative democracy, is that we must participate. Otherwise, we can't claim that we actually live in a democracy. I mean, it's.
And I think that's what we all have to remember. You can't just have words. Oh, I agree with you. I believe in you. I'm sorry. I need everyone to stand up. I need everyone to go to vigils. I need everyone to be participating.
Yeah.
If we're going to stop this, I need each and every one of us to do something.
Yeah.
We all do. The Gold Star families need you desperately.
Absolutely. And is there a website for Gold Star families?
There is. And it's Gold Star. I have Gold Star.
I think it's Gold Star Families.
It's .org. It's the letters. It's just the letters.
Right.
GSFP.org. .org. Yes.
Yeah. GSFP. There it is right there.
You see how my mind is a little fuzzy.
Yeah. Well, mine too. And there's Cindy's picture right there on the front page. I just pulled up the website.
There you go. Good.
Okay.
Good.
Great. Lynn Braddock, thank you so much for being with us. Thanks for the report from Crawford, Texas. Keep up the great work. Say hi to Michelle. And travel safely back here to Portland. When you get back, give us a shout. I'll put you in touch with Marsha Myers here in Portland and some of the other people if that's of value to you. And,
that sounds great. Sounds great.
Keep up the great work.
All right. And I want to thank you, Tom, for calling us and for letting us keep people updated. I really do.
Oh, my pleasure. I'm very pleased to have you on the program. Thanks, Lynn. Bye now.
Bye-bye now.
This is such a good thing, you know. The war is not a good thing. People dying is not a good thing. It is, however, you know, it's making lemonade out of lemons. It is such a good thing that people are waking up, that people are coming forward, that people are saying, hey, wait a minute. Politics is actually about all of our lives. You know, as a nation, we're sort of like a family. We're a community. And to participate in the community, be part of that community, means to be politically active, or at the very least, to be politically aware. You know, tragically, we're not teaching civics in our schools any longer, at least in any functional way. But we all have an obligation to be those teachers, to be awakeners in the historical context, in the present context, in the modern context, sharing the word. It's like, you know, the old saying, tag, you're it.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
There's no easy walk to freedom. No easy walk to freedom. Keep on walking and you shall be free. That's how we're gonna make history.
And welcome. Welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes past the hour, or 24 and a half minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. Our number 1-866-889-8894 here on the place where smart people get their news. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C. is on the line with our report from Washington, D.C. Hey, they're deep in the belly of the beast, Victoria.
Very much so, yes, in the belly, and actually, frankly, the belly is not quite as hot today as it has been, which is very nice. The heat is all down in Crawford, Texas.
Yes, yeah, we were just speaking with one of the Gold Star mothers down there in Crawford not 5 minutes ago.
Wow.
And they really got energized by Joan Baez showing up yesterday. But the main point I think that she made was that they're going to follow Bush to Salt Lake City. The mayor of Salt Lake City has called for people to show up and protest Bush's being there. They're going to follow him to Idaho. They're going to follow him back to Washington, D.C. I have a feeling that George Bush and Herbert Hoover, there's so many parallels between their two administrations. This is going to be another one. It's like the Bonus Army was to Hoover, the Gold Star Families for Peace are to Bush. And ironically, in both cases, it was veterans who came after the presidents.
That's very interesting. I hadn't thought of that.
That was the big turning point in the Hoover presidency that sealed his fate, that, you know, that he would never win re-election in 1932, was when he sent MacArthur and Eisenhower in to bust up the Bonus Army and set their little shanties on fire. And, you know, the Hoovervilles and whatnot, but primarily the Bonus Army.
You know, I think in this case, obviously the administration isn't going to send anybody in to bust this up, but I think if we have more behavior like we had from this so-called patriot driving over crosses, and I don't think there's been enough in the news about that, frankly, I think that's the kind of thing that is going to drive the public even further against this war and this administration. The idea that those who oppose the protesters only know how to oppose them by shooting and bulldozing.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, well said. So what's going on in Washington, D.C. right now?
Well, people are anxiously looking over to Iraq as midnight approaches as to whether they're going to get a constitution written. And I think I can be fairly strong in saying that the answer is no, they're not. And exactly what that means, we don't know, because if they don't get it written, it's not like everybody says, oh, you know, detention. They're already in detention. They've only got the heat about a few hours a day. So,
well, they're already in violation of the law, too, are they not? I mean, if they didn't have the Constitution a week ago, they were supposed to dissolve.
So then what do? They all dissolve, and then...
Then you have another election.
Right, you have another election.
And there's all, you know, now we've got all this evidence that we rigged the last election to make sure that the Shia didn't get an absolute majority, a two-thirds majority, even though they did. But in terms of numbers of people, you know, Seymour Hersh has just blown that wide open with his report in The New Yorker about how we actually rigged the Iraqi election. Will we have to do it again?
Well, you know, the cynics would say, look, we've had practice in Ohio and in Florida now. We're getting good at it.
We're getting good at it.
We're on a roll.
We're on a roll, yeah. And in Afghanistan as well. We put the, you know, the UNICAL consultant, Hamid Karzai, in charge.
But he dresses well.
Yes, he does. He's got a good eye for color.
He has.
Especially his hats. Yeah, and those scarves that he wears. Okay.
So it is a very strange week, and I think people are really trying to figure out whether what Senator Chuck Hagel said on the Sunday shows yesterday was significant in the long term, when he said that it was like Vietnam, when he said that, look, we've been there 2.5 years, we're not winning. And he was on with Senator George Allen of Virginia, who said some really quite incredibly stupid things. And I don't live in Virginia, so he's not mine, but nevertheless, he's local. You always hope the local guy's going to do a bit better than that.
Mm-hmm.
So Chuck Hagel may come in for a little bit of sliming, I think Washington is thinking, and yet that doesn't seem to be working as well these days as it did. So really, you know, Republicans are the ones who seem to be objecting to the direction that the war is taking in Iraq more than Democrats. Democrats seem to be, once again, not really too sure exactly where they're supposed to stand on this.
Well, they went after Voinovich pretty hard when he spoke poorly of Bolton. But he's still there, you know.
He's still there, and he has support. He has support of the federal workers. He's done a lot for them. Voinovich is one of those guys who seems to be clean. They can't get him.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, Victoria Jones, thanks a lot for the report from Washington, D.C. Great to hear from you today. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 29 minutes past the hour.
We'll be right back.
fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Yes, indeed. Nowhere to run, George. Did you see the thing on CNN last night? Dead wrong. An hour-long expose of the lies told by the Bush administration. It was really quite remarkable. Now, here's a little piece. This is Larry Wilkerson starts out with this. Actually, I believe it starts out with David Kaye speaking about how they got into Iraq and they discovered that there were no weapons of mass destruction. Then we go to Larry Wilkerson, who was the number two guy to Colin Powell, talking about how Colin Powell took that news, shall we say.
Once Kay is in Iraq, it's almost immediately clear to him that the WMD stockpiles he and his thousand-strong team are searching for are not there. The aluminum tubes are an early signal.
When we got in, we found they really were part of a rocket program.
The bioweapons labs described by Curveball don't exist. In private emails, Kay begins to warn Tenet that the evidence is falling apart.
And here's Wilkerson.
George actually did call the secretary and said, I'm really sorry to have to tell you. We don't believe there were any mobile labs for making biological weapons. This was third or fourth telephone call. And I think it's fair to say the secretary and Mr. Tenet at that point ceased being close. I mean, you can be sincere and you can be honest and you can believe what you're telling the secretary. But three or four times on substantive issues like that, it's difficult to maintain any warm feelings.
Yeah, to say the very least. Yeah, I'm sure that CNN will be replaying this thing. Don't miss it. It is absolutely brilliant. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. And Josh in Atlanta, Georgia on the line. Hey, Josh, what's up?
Hi, Tom. A little rant for you. I'm going to try to make it quick. I'm going to try to talk fast. Are they leaders or representatives? I mean, this is not a semantics issue. The difference is clear. A leader is one who commands others. A representative is someone elected to speak on and act on behalf of others.
Right.
And a little story. And
Are you asking? I mean, you know, the Constitution is fairly clear. The president, the members of Congress are representatives. They are not leaders.
Right. And, I mean, this should be a part of the, you know, Cindy Sheehan should start, explaining the difference to the world since people are paying attention to her. A little story, in fact, from 1998. One of our guys, deputy chief of mission at the this is also on CNN.com.
Mm-hmm.
He was deputy chief of mission at the U.S. Embassy in Pakistan, Alan Eastham Jr.
Right.
He met with Waqil Ahmed, who was an aide to the Taliban leader Mullah Omar.
Mm-hmm.
And in 98, they were talking about what could be done with Osama bin Laden. And whether or not to assassinate him, drive him out of Afghanistan so they could arrest him, or this is after the Cole, USS Cole thing.
Right.
And they were talking about maybe dropping missiles on him. And the Taliban made it clear they didn't want to oppose Osama bin Laden in any way because he was a war hero from the Soviet invasion.
Right.
And the people loved him, and they would be driven out of power if they opposed him. They knew that. And Eastham, our guy, responded by telling Ahmed, the Taliban had to realize for itself that, quote, the role of political leadership is to shape public opinion, not to decline to act because they think opinion is otherwise.
Wow. Wow. Now, at the same time, I mean, you have to realize we were acknowledging the Taliban. I mean, one of George Bush's first things that he did when he came into office, I believe it was in May of 2001, was he gave $54 million to the Taliban for opium poppy eradication programs.
Yeah,
and you know, and they did. They took that money and gave it to the warlords and said, "Quit growing the poppies." And they did. They quit growing the poppies. And then when it became apparent to us, or we believed, and you know, there still hasn't been a trial, but the evidence is pretty solid that Osama bin Laden was behind 9/11. We went to the Taliban and said, "Give us Osama bin Laden." And they said, "Well, we don't think that you'll give him a fair trial. We want him to be tried by Muslims. But if you will give him to any other Muslim nation where he will have a trial and evidence will be presented and you can give us any preliminary evidence that indicates that he had anything to do with 9/11, we will do that. We will turn him over." And at that point, we said, "No, we're not going to let you do that. And we're going to invade you." But there was an article in the paper today, and Josh, thanks for the call and thanks for pointing this out. There was an article in the paper today that pointed out that this is one of the deadliest months so far in Afghanistan.
in Afghanistan. If you're an American soldier and you're posted to Afghanistan, your odds of dying on a per capita basis are actually higher than in Iraq. And you know, because Afghanistan has slipped out of our control. Afghanistan, keep in mind, is the country that defeated the Soviet Union, which is next door. For us, it's on the other side of the planet. And now, you know, the people refer to the president of Afghanistan, Mr. Hamid Karzai, as the mayor of Kabul, because that's pretty much all he controls, and not even all of Kabul at that. The women are back in the burqas, the Taliban is back controlling a good chunk of the country, maybe as much as half of it, and the warlords control the other half of it, and Hamid Karzai controls the city of Kabul and a little bit of, what is it, Kandahar, I think, the other city. And, I mean, basically, there's two cities that he controls. Lynn in Houston, Texas, is with us on the line. Lynn, you were at Camp Casey.
I was.
Hey, tell us what it's like.
It's unbelievable. It's unbelievably awe-inspiring. The people that are there, the group spirit, the sense of history, it's just, it's almost impossible to describe. I'm trying to blog it, and it's going to take me all day.
That's great. Where are you going to be blogging it, Lynn?
On HoustonDemocrats.com.
Okay. Great. And what motivated you to go to Camp Casey?
I just couldn't stay away. I'm close enough to get there, living in Houston.
So you could drive there?
And I may go back next week and maybe just a day trip instead of staying over the weekend, because unfortunately life does get in the way. But you want to just stop your life for a minute and just stay there. And there are people that have done that. There are people there that have quit their jobs and are just there and they're staying. And
wow.
I wish I could do that, but I just unfortunately can't.
Yeah.
But it was just amazing walking around. I met Lynn Braddock. She just walked right up to me and introduced herself and thanked me for coming. And I was like, oh, you know, I wasn't there to be thanked. And that I was just awe-inspired by the people that were there.
Mm.
And I was there while Arlington West was setting up. And some of my friends from Houston for Memorial Day had labeled flags with the names of all the fallen veterans, all the fallen soldiers. And they brought all the Texas flags and the flags from Casey's unit.
Mm-hmm.
And planted them around the new Arlington West out there, and it was just incredible.
That's great. That's great. Lynn, thank you for the report.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling in and letting us know about it. I appreciate it. I want to share a song with you, and I'm asking for a little help. I'm suspecting the folks in our chat room will be able to help me out on this probably quite quickly, although if you can call with the information. We've got a piece of music that we've been using for a bumper for a while, we can't remember where we got it, you know, whether somebody emailed it to us or we found it on a website or somebody sent us the disc. We get people sending us discs all the time, and, I can't claim to be the most organized person in the world, nobody on our staff can lay claim to that. And I want to know who is the musician playing this piece of music, because I want to give it more airplay, but I want to give him some credit for it and, find out if there's a website for it and whatnot. So this is a song called Taking My Country Back. I'm going to play the song here. So, you know, we'll pretend this is the music radio for a minute, because this is a great song in any case. And if you know, and this is not a contest, I mean, I'm just genuinely looking for the information. If you know who this artist is and how we can find out information about this artist, please let us know.
Country music's got mamas and daddies. We got barrooms and no heartbreak songs. But I'm here today to stand up and say how I feel about my home sweet home. What's left, what's right, and what's wrong. And I'm taking my country back. Son, you ain't been doing her right. Oh, I've been watching you and I don't like how you've been treating my and strikes. You took our jobs and sent them overseas. Now we owe billions to the red Chinese. You blew the budget and you bossed Iraq. So I'm taking my country back. We had a bundle in the treasury drawer, more than there had ever been before. But every day we're drowning deeper in debt. Maybe 4 years should be all you get. Then you gave tax breaks to the millionaires, and you tried to make the working man pay. But you can't tax
respects a man when his job's not there. Now look at where we are today. Hey, I'm taking my country back. Son, you ain't been doing her right. Well, I've been watching you and I don't like how you've been treating my stars and stripes. Got too many fancy friends for me. The Saudis treat you like you're understand why you were hot, 'cause bin Laden never did get caught. So you said we had Saddam to blame, tried to tell us it was all the same. But now the years roll by and our kids keep dying. You don't even have a plan to bring them home. And those WMD you promised on TV, hey, admit it, you figured it wrong. So I'm taking my country back. Now you don't know my name, but you know who I am. I'm your everyday. Church and flag. I'm taking my country back.
And the, there you go. Folks in our chat room telling me this is David Kent. I'm still trying to, we're still trying to get a URL to how to find and buy the record on this thing. There's a, Injustice Now blog. It says, there's the lyrics, and they say it's from Nashville's top writers and musicians, and Honky Tonkers for Truth. And but that doesn't give the name, and then, hang on just a second here. There we go. There's another URL. No, that one won't display. When a poll song, whoever posted that, that URL is dead. So anyhow, according to some folks, it's Taking My Country Back by David Kent, but I still don't have a URL for it. So if you know, I'd like to find out. Just, you know, one of those things. Great song, Taking My Country Back, apparently by David Kent. But we'll find out as time goes on here. Step by step, as they say. We will eventually figure this stuff out. In the meantime, speaking of the disasters of the Bush administration, the increased price in oil around the world, in part the result of the reality of peak oil trickling in part the result of George Bush's And actually, going all the way back to Ronald Reagan, four presidencies worth of insane trade policies and three presidencies of insane economic policies. I will give it to Bill Clinton's domestic economic policies were pretty good. His trade policies were nuts, but his domestic policies were pretty good. But the result of this, the dollar has been driven down, the price of oil gone up. You combine that with peak oil, the price of oil going up. And here are a few of the consequences of this for the rest of the world. And I think this is something that folks really need to know about. I mean, it's, you know, it's really worth, you know, finding out. Last week, the BBC reported that dozens were killed in fuel riots against Yemen, across Yemen, when the government withdrew subsidies, resulting in dramatic price increases. So in Yemen, they're having riots because of fuel. All across Indonesia, people are lining up at gas stations in response to developing fuel shortages. In one city, half the public transport was inoperable due to a lack of fuel. So Indonesia is the fourth most populous country in the world. In Zimbabwe, the government has moved to deregulate fuel procurement in the face of severe shortages, waits for hours of hours for buses, gas lines that are blocks long, bread shortages, black market price for gasoline, 10 times the official rate now. Many of the poorer countries that use oil to make electricity, diesel generators, Nicaragua, for example, starting to ration electricity or blacking out districts, the poorer districts, between 7 and 10 p.m., hours of peak usage. In Tanzania, with the highest gasoline taxes in East Africa and a chaotic oil marketing system, they're seeing plans for economic growth suffocated by high-priced oils. Tanzania also demands fuel for the landlocked states of Malawi, Rwanda, the Eastern Congo, Burundi, and Uganda. So you can see it's pretty amazing. Pretty amazing. Tom in Minneapolis on the line. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Just had to call, man. Bush just finished giving his propaganda speech in Utah.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And he did it over and over again, linking 9/11 with Iraq and Afghanistan. Of course, he always puts those two together.
Right. This is his last gasp. I mean,
And here's the other thing.
Yeah.
He's comparing it to World War II and the sacrifices of World War II veterans, right? And Democrats have to say we supported 100% the Afghanistan invasion because that was the real link. Because they're trying to make us look like we're pacifist on the whole war on terror.
Yeah.
And we got to make it clear that we support Afghanistan and Al-Qaeda attack, you know what I mean?
Yeah, good point, Tom. Yeah. I appreciate it. Thank you for the Bush report. Jeez. Oh, my. 9/11, 9/11, 9/11. War on terror, terror, terror. 9/11, 9/11. World War II. Now he's pulling World War II out of the hat. Now, there was a war fought by a good liberal. Good old Franklin Roosevelt, one of the finest liberals who ever governed this country. Right up there with Thomas Jefferson. 10 minutes before the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
I'm George W. Bush, and I approve this message.
They gave up the old Bible Belt ballyhoo. You bamboozled them. Forget your AWOL and your DUI. You gave them a show that always pleases. Your friends claimed you were endorsed. Jesus, you razzle-dazzle-dum, and make sane people cry.
Yes, welcome back, my friends. I believe that's the Billionaires for Bush. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you 4.5 minutes before the hour. Americans have always taken pride in breaking records. Oh, by the way, before I get to that, some of the folks in the chat room have directed me to a BuzzFlash page that tells the story of the song that I played for you earlier. It's about a group of Nashville musicians. They put this thing together. It was written by David Kent, the guy who also wrote Austin, a Blake Shelton hit. And they went shopping around looking for somebody to sing it, some big-name Democrat in the country music field. Nobody was willing to put their career on the line. They ended up with Tony Stampley, who is a session singer. He's not a name singer, but, session singer, you know, one of those voices that you hear that doesn't have a name attached to it. But his father was country legend Joe Stampley, who was, you know, big back in the day. And he just did a great, great job with it. So the voice was Tony Stampley. The writer was David Kent. And there's at least one website I've got here, one from apparently a radio station out on the West Coast, 1010KXXT, that has an MP3 of it on their website. But what I'm really looking for is a way that somebody could buy this thing, because I've had a lot of requests for it. You know, how can I buy that? How can I get a CD that has that? You know, I want to send one to my uncle. I want to send one to my brother. I want to play it for my nephew, you know, whatever. Still looking. Still looking. Apparently, there was a website, www.takinmycountryback.com, and when BuzzFlash did the story on them, they had 90,000 hits in just a few days. But that website seems to be down, whether it's been hacked or whether they ran out of money or what. I don't know. But I think it's a great song, and I think it could be a movement song. So, and with that, and Country Joe McDonald's new song. You know, his support the troops. another marvelous piece of music there. So it's starting. It's like during the Vietnam War, there was this whole body of anti-war music that emerged. It's happening again. The demonstrations and the parallels to Vietnam are pretty startling. I think, frankly, though, what we're going to see as time goes by is that the better parallels are the parallels to the Bonus Army, you know, where the veterans against Herbert Hoover. Time will tell. We'll see how it plays out.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 7 minutes past the hour. Well, we'll be in 10 seconds. There you go. Welcome back to our program. The place where our talking points come from, Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank or the RNC. The real free speech zone here. No barbed wire. We won't drag you off if you got an oil for no blood for oil bumper sticker on your car. George Bush just finished giving his speech in Salt Lake City. Here's the news release, the story, this is from CNN, from early this morning. President Bush will launch a new round of speeches to rally support for the war in Iraq, advisors said Sunday, as protesters camped outside Bush's Texas home and polls showed weaker support for the two-year conflict. Now, can you just imagine these guys sitting around saying, you know, we got a problem here. People are realizing that there's no there. You know, that y'all made up this war and that it's based on lies and that people are dying for a lie and that, you know, Bill Clinton, for whatever his moral failings, he told a lie and nobody seems to have died from that. Nothing. There wasn't even anything infectious involved. I mean, it was just like nobody died. And now we've got all these dead people. What are we going to do? Well, let's try to tie it back to 9/11. But, Mr. Bush, Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11. We've got to tie it back. But, Mr. Bush, you actually told the national press that Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11. You know, I mean, you actually said that. It's been, you know, we're on the record that Iraq had nothing to do, Saddam Hussein had nothing to do with 9/11. So how can we try and tie this war in Iraq back to 9/11? I mean, you said it.
We've had no evidence that Saddam Hussein was involved with the September the 11th.
No. We've had no evidence that Saddam Hussein was involved. I mean, you said it.
We've had no evidence that Saddam Hussein was involved with the September the 11th.
No. So, you know, what can we do? Well, don't worry. People's memories are short. We'll just trust the media not to play that clip. And then last night, CNN, dead wrong. They played this marvelous program where they just laid it right out. I mean, it was just, they just laid it right out.
Secretary of State Colin Powell will make the case for war in a speech to the United Nations.
We also have satellite photos that indicate that banned materials have recently been moved from a number of Iraqi weapons of mass destruction facilities.
Powell will put America's credibility and his own on the line.
So he came through the door that morning and he had in his hand a sheaf of papers and he said, this is what I've got to present at the United Nations according to the White House and you need to look at it. Because,
you know, Colonel Larry Wilkerson, Colin Powell's longtime friend and advisor, was his chief of staff.
It was anything but an intelligence document. It was, as some people characterized it later, sort of a Chinese menu from which you could pick and choose.
So, and then they continue, and it's just a marvelous piece. CNN's Dead Wrong played last night, and as I recall it, 7, 8, 9, like 10 or 11 o'clock Eastern time, And, you know, when the ratings are down, and but nonetheless, it played. And then it repeated out here on the West Coast anyway. So I recommend if CNN is going to play that thing dead wrong again, that you check it out. And if they're not, that you ask them to. I frankly don't know what the status is of future playings of it. But it was remarkable. So anyhow, George and his buddies are sitting around going, well, you know, we've got to figure out a way to sell this war to people because, you know, they're getting it that we lied. And, well, okay, let's try to tie this thing back to World War II. Well, what did Tojo and Hitler have to do with Iraq? Well, we'll figure out something. Yeah. You think that'll fly? Maybe. It's going to be really interesting to see how the right-wingers take this new speech by Bush, conflating 9/11 and Iraq and 9/11 and World War II. Anyhow, from the news story, here's the news story. Senior aides say Bush will attempt to portray the Iraq conflict in the context of long wars like World War II, which U.S. forces fought from 1941 to 1945. Gee, 3 years. My recollection is it was 44 months, which is a little shorter than the period from 9/11 till today. Say what? The war on terrorism has lasted longer than World War II? Yeah. Anyhow, back to the news story. They say the president will also invoke the September 11, 2001 attacks, arguing once again that the insurgents battling American troops in Iraq share the same ideology as the Al-Qaeda operatives who crashed hijacked jetliners into the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, and a Pennsylvania field. Oh! Now I get it. They share the same ideology. Do you mean by ideology religion? Do you mean by ideology that they don't like American foreign policy? Because as I recall, and I'm pretty sure I'm recalling this correctly, when Osama bin Laden back in the mid-90s, after we had helped him and supported him in pulling together Al-Qaeda to fight the Soviet Union, and he succeeded in throwing the Soviet Union out of Afghanistan with a little help from his friends, the Americans, Osama bin Laden left Afghanistan to go back to his homeland, Saudi Arabia, with his merry band. And he looked around the Middle East and he said, okay, what country can I conquer next? Guy with a bit of a complex, you see. And he looked at the country that was bordering Saudi Arabia on the southeastern border and said, you know, there's a country here in the Middle East where they allow women to have to work. They can go to school. They don't have to wear the burqa. They're wearing blue jeans. They have makeup on. They can vote. We can't have that. They're driving cars. Look at what they're allowing women to do in this country. We've got to take this country down. And so Osama bin Laden got together several thousand of his old Al-Qaeda guys, and they got together in Saudi Arabia, and they started heading for the Iraq border because they were going to take out Saddam Hussein because he was running the most secular of the Arab governments. And the Saudis found out about it, the Saudi royal family. And the U.S. said, hey, you know, we don't want a war between Saudi Arabia and Iraq. We're buying oil from both of you. Enough already. So they arrested Osama bin Laden and deported him to the Sudan, a country in sub-Saharan Africa, where he then started up again. Got a factory going that was making, now the Republicans would tell you it was making aspirin. Actually, it was making a precursor for chemical gas. Bill Clinton bombs it. The Republicans are all screaming, oh, he's trying to direct our attention away from Monica Lewinsky. Yeah. And then Osama bin Laden says to us, we, the United States, that there are two things that he is not willing to tolerate. One is that this corrupt government in Saudi Arabia, which arrested him and threw him out of his own country simply because he was trying to retain the purity of Islam in Iraq after he had succeeded in doing so in Afghanistan. He wanted to install the Taliban in Iraq as well. That the United States government had to stop supporting and propping up the corrupt royal family in Saudi Arabia. And the main way that they were, the way that we were corrupting, you know, supporting them was by buying their oil. He felt that we were draining the country of their natural wealth, their God-given wealth in his mind. And that if we were going to buy oil from them, we should pay at least $200 a barrel. This, according to Newt Gingrich. And then he also said, and the other condition is you've got American soldiers on Saudi soil. George Bush Sr. put them there in 1991 as a staging area to fly them into Kuwait for the Gulf War. He said, get your soldiers out of Saudi Arabia. That's holy land. That's the home of Islam. It is not allowed that there be men drinking alcohol and that there be women driving around and not wearing burqas and not appropriately covered. Not allowed. And if you don't do those two things, Osama bin Laden said, he was going to come and get us. And sure enough, he did, as far as we can tell. So Bush now is going to try to say, in fact, he just said it today, that the people that were fighting in Kuwait have the same ideology as Osama bin Laden, the people who shot down, who hit 9/11 and brought down the towers. But the reality is that the people who did 9/11 did so because they wanted the United States out of Saudi Arabia, and Bush very quietly about 9 months ago pulled our troops out of Saudi Arabia, by the way. And because they wanted us to start paying more for the oil we were getting from Saudi Arabia, and we're on the way for that. And that is, neither of those two things, as far as I can tell, are even on the Chinese menu over in Iraq. In Iraq, we've got homegrown insurgents, about 90-95% of the people who are shooting at our young men and women. People who just simply don't want their country occupied. And then you've got, by some estimates, as few as 1,000, by some estimates, as many as 10,000. This is in a country of 30-some-odd million. Foreign fighters in there who are fighting against us for a variety of reasons. They hate Americans. They want to make a statement. It's good training. They're practicing, whatever. They support the local insurgency. They support the Shia. They support the Sunnis. I mean, pretty much everybody except they're supporting the Kurds. As far as I know, the Kurds aren't involved in all this. But it's not the same ideology. It is not the same ideology. And watch the news tonight and see if they simply repeat George Bush saying, the people that were fighting in Iraq have the same ideology as the people that hit us on 9/11. Because it is not the same ideology. It's the same religion. And if that's what he means, then he might as well say that we've declared war on Islam, which I think would be an incredibly stupid thing to do. But I'm telling you, the people in the Middle East understand the difference between the ideology of Osama bin Laden, which many of them don't agree with, by the way, and the ideology of the people in Iraq who are saying, please get out of our country. The 80-some members of the Iraqi National Assembly who signed a letter to George Bush saying, please, please leave right now. It's a different ideology. And it's got nothing to do with 9/11. This is Bush grasping for straws, flailing about, a desperate attempt to try and paint this thing as something it's not. 20 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Round here, we always stand up straight. Round here, something radiates. We came from Nashville with a suitcase in her hand. She says she
And welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 24 and a half past the hour, to be precise. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, Gary in Joshua. Oh, Gary, before you pop on there, just let me very quickly, one of the folks in the chat room let me know that CNN is going to be replaying that program, which isn't, you know, it's not the whole truth and nothing but the truth. It's pretty good, though. It's a pretty good start. They're going to be replaying it on Saturday starting at 3 p.m. I believe that's Eastern time, and two more times. So check your local listings, as they say in the TV business. Gary and Joshua Tree, you're live and on the air.
Hi, Tom. One of the things that I seem to recall from the 80s, Bin Laden was in Lebanon, and he saw the devastation brought on by the bombardment by U.S. ships. And he made up his mind back then that he was going to bring devastation to America. So America knew what it was like to see blown up children, blown up homes, and, you know, chaos.
Actually, wasn't that Israel that was bombing Lebanon at that time?
Oh, I thought there was an American ship that did that, but I'm not quite sure.
No, there was an American ship off the coast of Israel that got bombed by the Israelis.
No, I'm not talking about the Liberty. That was back in 97.
Yeah.
I mean, 67. I'm talking about around the time of the Lebanese Civil War.
Uh-huh.
He was in Lebanon, and they drove him out of Lebanon, too.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, Gary, you've exceeded my knowledge database, so I'll
okay,
take your word for it.
Okay, look into that.
Yeah, I will.
Okay.
Thank you. Good
Bye.
To hear from you. 1-866-889-8894, by the way, our telephone number. Looks like Tom DeLay may be in a little bit of a problem here. The Public Citizens Energy Program, you know, Public Citizen, I believe it's citizen.org is their website. They have just, issued a report, let's say. Westar Energy rightly fined for illicit contributions to Congress, but what about the lawmakers? See, what happened was Westar Energy, the company's paying the bribe, got nailed. But the lawmakers accepting the bribe, nothing so far. So they say, you know, that they applaud the FEC's decision to fine Westar two of its executives and a Washington, D.C. lobbyist, a total of $40,500. But what about the guys that they were bribing? Specifically, Tom DeLay of Texas and Joe Barton of Texas. What about them? You got this 2002 memo in April from Westar lobbyist Richard Borneman to Westar Vice President Doug Lawrence recommending that they give a platinum package of campaign contributions, including $25,000 in soft money, to Texans for a Republican Majority, Trim Pack, a leadership pack of Tom DeLay's, $31,500 in hard money to a list of candidates associated with Barton and Towson, for the purpose of gaining access to the legislators. Should we be prosecuting members of Congress who take bribes? I think so. Here's an email from Borneman to Lawrence. I absolutely detest asking you for money. We all prefer to think that our powerful personalities and strategic brilliance transcend such grubbiness. Anyway, let's sum up the needs discussed in our conversation today. They keep to the boundaries of the platinum budget as approved. In other words, we're going to give them the money. You know, the famous memo that we're paying this money. The contributions made in the first round were successful in opening the appropriate dialogue. This Westar trying to get access to Tom DeLay, and of course DeLay and his staff now saying, well, you know, Mr. DeLay spoke, Congressman spoke with Westar executives because it was the right thing to do. It's just a coincidence that he did it after they gave all that money to Trimpack and to the other Republicans, just like he recommended. That's just a coincidence, you see. Yeah. So citizen.org, Public Citizen, is saying, hey, let's hold the lawmakers accountable here. Let's hold the lawmakers accountable. Yes, indeed. What a plan. What a novel idea. They sent this to Noel Hillman, the chief of the Department of Justice Criminal Division. And I suspect they'll get a reply just about the time that hell freezes over. But one can hope. 29 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Listening to you, I get
And welcome back, my friends. 33 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, Jeff in Boulder, Colorado. Normally in Boulder, Colorado. He's actually at Camp Casey right now in Crawford, Texas. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the program.
Tom, how are you? This is such a great time down here. It has been fantastic. I was coming down here expecting a little ragtag army of women, and what a surprise this was. Saturday, I think we had, there's no way to count, but it's like counting bees in a beehive, but I'm guesstimating somewhere between 500 and 1,000 people showed up. You've got people down at the Peace House in Crawford. You've got people up at Camp Casey 1, more people up at Camp Casey 2. And if you get too hot, you can go down to the swimming hole. There's a waterfall down there, and you can go stand in the waterfalls. It was a wonderful time.
Wow.
And I am just so impressed. I came down here thinking, I have my little, 12-volt battery all charged up, ready to turbocharge these guys, and they gave me a kilovolt back. It's just been a fantastic time.
So how Jeff, how did you get there? I'm curious.
I drove down.
From Boulder.
But I'd say to anybody out there listening, they're going to be here for one more weekend, and if you have to hitchhike, if you can drive, if you fly, if you can swim, whatever you have to do, come down and become part of this.
Why?
This was such, because the revolution has started, and what I'm saying is you get so much more out of it than what you will anticipate in advance of I thought, well, I'll come down here and encourage the people and give them my support. And what they gave me back, there are people from all over the world who have come here. There's people from all over the country. If people from Australia and people from England can come here, then if you live in New Mexico, if you live in Colorado, by all means, you can make it here.
Okay.
And whatever you're doing back home, it can wait. There's just so much stuff going on here. It's been such an exciting time. And the people of Crawford, the people at the Peace House, people have just opened their arms and welcomed. I missed the goings on up at the tent up at Camp Casey 2 Saturday night because I stopped in the store to get an ice cream and some of the locals came out to talk to me and we ended up talking for 3 hours. And even though they're all very strong Bush supporters, they just really, really wanted to know, what we were doing there, and they wanted to talk, and it was a great time.
What were they talking about?
Well, they wanted to know, what we were doing and why we were against the war. And basically, I think they just wanted to talk. And I assessed the situation, and I said, I can come in here and I can say, the war is wrong and all of this stuff. But I think what they really wanted and what I thought was really important is to build the common ground that we're all looking for the same thing here. We all want a strong America. We all want peace. We all want our troops to come home. And they were very, very receptive to that. And they were shaking my hand and they were hugging me and they were welcoming me and it was great. But the entire experience here has been such a phenomenal experience in my life. I wasn't around for when they had the what's that thing in New York that they had back in the 70s?
Woodstock.
I don't know that I would call this a Woodstock, but it's the closest thing that we've had in a long time.
So this is this generation's March on Washington, or this generation's Woodstock, or this generation, whatever. This is a signal point. Although the protests against the war 3 years ago that were brought out more people than any protests in the history of the world all around the planet, but they kind of appeared and then they went away once the war started. I thought that was interesting.
Jeff, it is starting again.
Yeah, good. Jeff, thanks for the call. Thanks for letting us
Thank
know
you,
your experience there. It's fascinating. Matt in Arlington, Texas on the line. Hey, Matt, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. That guy that called earlier about all of us getting behind the war in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
We don't need any more frames, myths, aligned frames like that, you know, no, no. Rahul Mahajan has written about this. Other people have written about it. It's all another scam, like you pointed out so many times. Clinton took it as a law enforcement thing to go get whatever in Oklahoma City.
Right.
The answer to that question was not bombing the crap out of Afghanistan and then finding out it was as ungovernable or unconquerable or whatever as the British and everybody else had.
Right. Yeah, the Afghans threw out the British, they threw out the Russians, and they're fixing to throw, and they, for all practical purposes, they've thrown us out. I mean, we control less than a majority of the country. And you make a good point, Matt, and see, but here's the you know, to look at it from a political point of view, and I think that that's Tom's position, Tom from Minneapolis is his position, is that Karl Rove is playing a game, a political game. He doesn't care about what's best for the country. That's very clear now. He doesn't care even what's best for the government. You know, he cares what's best for George W. Bush's political future and the Republicans' political future. And the fact is that the vote to invade Afghanistan was either 99-1 or 99-0. It was virtually unanimous. The Democrats in Congress, in the Senate anyway, were completely in support of invading Afghanistan. And so what Bush is trying to do now is to essentially say that he's trying to rewrite history, to say that, you know, the Democrats were against invading Afghanistan and they're against invading Iraq, and you should just write them off because they're just a bunch of peaceniks and they'll be against any righteous war. They would have been against invading World War II. They would have been against taking out Hitler. Ironically, it was the Republicans who wanted to, who did not want us to intervene in World War II. But that's a whole other thing. And
like so many other things, our message gets screwed up and not put forward, but we need to keep pounding on it. I mean,
yeah.
The answer is not say, yeah, we're as revenge ready as and deluded as everybody else. And another thing I want to get in is you say, I wish you would stop using the 1800 figure. I mean, it's fairly conclusive now that it's low range 9,000, high range 15,000. The guys that died on the plane to Germany are just as dead as the ones that died on the ground in Iraq.
Well, Matt, over the last few months, I've been noticing, you know, occasionally these reports come through and they talk about where people died, and I've seen reports that talked about people who've died in Germany, who died in transport. I mean, they're actually reporting those as Iraqi casualties now.
Well, there's supposedly a Pentagon list that's floating around now, and I've seen it, and there's a movement trying to get everybody. Did your kid die? Where did he die? You know,
right.
It's a bunch of isolated mothers sitting there. Oh, my child is one of those 1800. Well, no, you know, he wasn't, because they're only counting the ones that died on the ground in Iraq.
Right, apparently that, if that is the case, and I don't know that for a fact. If that was the case, it's not the case right now. And so the question is, when did they change that policy? And I agree with you. I realize that there is an active effort now to try and figure out how many, you know, to try and get in contact with the parents of dead children from Iraq, dead soldiers, let's say, and see if the number exceeds 1800. And that's going to be a daunting task. It's going to be a huge, huge job, and I doubt that they'll have any success with it. But it'll be fascinating to see how it plays out. Matt, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. You know, the point that Matt was making about law enforcement is a really, really important one. My take on the invasion of Iraq is frankly different than the take of the Democratic Party. And, you know, I'm not going to criticize them for this. I'll just say this is my take on it. And I wrote an op-ed piece about it for Common Dreams at the time that you can still read if you go to tomhartman.com and click on the articles on democracy and scroll down. It's in there someplace. And my take on it was that the way that you fight terrorism is not some brand new technology. You don't fight terrorism. You don't fight ideologies with bullets and bombs. And you don't fight terrorists with armies. The British did not fight the IRA with the British Army. And once they tried, they got fairly close to it, and it made it far worse. The Italians did not fight the Red Brigades with their army. The Germans did not fight the Bader-Meinhof gang with their army. And for that matter, the Israelis did not fight the Palestinians with their army, by and large. I'm talking about the political battle. No, the way that you take out terrorists is with good police work. Today, this very day, a white Christian terrorist, Eric Rudolph, is being sentenced in down in, what is it, South Carolina, I believe it is. And there's a whole bunch of folks who do not want to go to the sentencing because he's going to give his, you know, his speech, and it's going to be full of anti-gay, anti-abortion, hateful rhetoric. But, you know, because he bombed a gay nightclub and he killed somebody there in Atlanta. And so anyhow, it's but the point is that we have had terrorists here in the United States. We had Eric Rudolph. We had Tim McVeigh. We've had several terrorists here in the United States. We track them down. We find them. Bill Clinton figured this out. And you don't have to eliminate our privacy rights, our human rights. You don't have to do away with them. You don't have to rewrite the Constitution. You don't have to give unlimited police authority to the police agencies. You don't have to create propaganda agencies. You don't have to put Karen Hughes in charge of propagandizing the rest of the world. You don't have to bring, you know, the wife of one of the Voice of America directors in to Camp Casey to be the Iraqi who's going to tell us how wonderful it is that we're in Iraq. You don't have to do any of that stuff. All you need is good police procedures to track down the terrorists. I mean, the Brits were able to do this with, you know, they had some people bomb the British subways, and within, what, 4 days, 5 days, they knew who it was, they knew who these kids were, they knew when they made the bombs, they knew where their parents were, they knew where they came from, they figured out why they did it. I mean, it's good police work. And we have done that in the United States, and with Oklahoma City, we did that. Oklahoma City, the second worst terrorist attack in the United States history. And it allowed the victims' families in Oklahoma City to gain closure. There goes Tim McVeigh. See you later, Tim. And I'm not even a proponent of the death penalty, but, you know, whether it was the death penalty or whether it was life in prison, there he goes. He's not going to be part of our society any longer. He's going to be permanently segregated from our society. He has been caught and convicted. The same in Italy when they finally got all the guys from the people who kidnapped Aldo Moro, the former prime minister, and killed him. These terrorists. Put him in jail. And after 9/11, Osama bin Laden, the entire Arab world was looking at Osama bin Laden going, holy cow, this guy is nuts. They were holding candlelight vigils in Tehran, Iran, in support of the United States. And if George Bush had simply done what Bill Clinton did and said to the world, we have been attacked. And now, remember, when Oklahoma City first went off, they thought it was Muslim terrorists who did it for several days. If George Bush had simply did what Bill Clinton did and said, we have been attacked by terrorists, we have some intelligence we'll share with other police agencies around the world. Let's get Interpol in on this. Let's get cooperation from all the governments around the world. And let's track these people down and bring them to justice. When the Afghans said that if we simply provided them with some evidence that bin Laden was involved, that they would turn him over to an Arab country for trial, we could have had closure on this thing. It could have been the end of it. We didn't need to invade Afghanistan. You could say, well, isn't it wonderful we overthrew the Taliban? Well, I don't think the average Afghani thinks that right now, frankly. It's not like and this is not a statement of support of the Taliban. It's that wars don't make things better, generally speaking. At least wars that don't have an end, that don't have a clear victory, and then don't produce change. And we had all this election in Afghanistan. Yes, and the country has since been lost. So, you know, I agree with our last caller. I'm sorry, I've forgotten your name. That we should have done, you know, and I've been saying this very consistently for 2 years, more than 2 years now. We should have done in Afghanistan what we did here in Oklahoma City, and what the British did, and what the Italians did, and what the Germans did, and what the Spanish did with ETA, with the Basque separatist groups. We should use good police procedures to track down these criminals. And the whole world would be with us instead of the whole world hating us like they do now because of the absolutely stupid way Bush handled us. Roy in Rio Rancho, New Mexico on the line. Hey, Roy, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Tom. A couple quick points. I understand that Bush was going to try to tie World War II and the long struggle into this long struggle.
Apparently he did.
I haven't heard the speech, but... I went in and went to the day-date calculator from Pearl Harbor to the signing of the treaty on this deck of the Missouri. It was 1,365 days.
Which is about 44 months, isn't it?
I didn't actually calculate.
Yeah, I'd seen it. I'd seen it printed someplace in months.
1365. Okay. Since 9/11, since you want to tie it back to 9/11 for Iraq, since 9/11, it's been 1,441 days.
Wow.
And we're no closer now than we were when the Marines were invading Guadalcanal, for crying out loud.
Yeah.
Mentioning Oklahoma City, shift gears real quick.
Sure.
What happened to the guy that got caught with the pipe bomb trying to get on an airplane in Oklahoma City that was a white guy?
Yeah, last week.
That there, you know, I mean, it's just like...
With a pipe bomb.
It was never front page headline,
no,
to my knowledge.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't, but...
If Buzzflash hadn't ever reported on it, I would have never known it. But all of a sudden, the mayor of Oklahoma City said, well, this guy was just a normal old Oklahoma kid, you know, he was out there blowing up things all the way since he'd been a kid.
Yeah.
Now, wait a second. You're getting on an airplane with a bomb. Shouldn't that be kind of front page news?
Yeah. As far as I know, the only national TV media that handled it, carried it, was Keith Olbermann.
I didn't, you know, I mean, it was just so bizarre. And as you were, you know, kind of discussing the Afghanistan thing, which I totally agree with you, isn't it amazing that you always have to disclaim that, hey, I don't support the Afghanistan, or, you know, we have to say we don't like Osama, we don't like bin Laden.
Right.
You know, that. We always have to qualify that we're not cooperating.
I know. It's incredible.
Isn't that bizarre?
It is. It really is. Roy, thanks a lot for the call. It truly is. Yes, I'm still a patriot. 10 minutes before the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Her newborn baby's wailing like a moaning dove. An old man with broken teeth, stranded without love. Do I understand your question, man? Is it hopeless and forlorn? Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm.
And welcome back, my friends. 55 and a half minutes past the hour, or 4.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. For those of you who don't listen to right-wing talk radio, just a little, you know, update on what's been going on over the last week or so. When this whole Able Danger thing came out, the Pentagon had been concealing from the FBI during the Clinton administration, continuing right up through the 9/11 investigation earlier this year, the ending of the 9/11 commission, that for that entire period of time, the Pentagon, Department of Defense, had been concealing knowledge that they had about Mohammed Atta and the 9/11 hijackers operating inside the United States and their affiliation with Al-Qaeda. And, of course, the right-wing bloviators said, ah, this happened. It started during the Clinton administration. Ah, this must have something to do with some Democrat. Ah, look at the memo that Jamie Gorelick wrote. Remember Jamie Gorelick, the Democrat on the 9/11 commission? She wrote this memo, you know, and actually her memo, which they say created the wall between the CIA and the FBI, did none of the above, but that's a whole other rant. But in any case, let's say that she did. She actually, her memo was simply about the law. She didn't do it. Congress did it. But she was pointing out what the law was. But this was a leak between the department, or this was the failure to communicate between the Department of Defense and the FBI. Nothing to do with that legislation. Nothing to do with Jamie Gorelick. Nothing. Zero. Zip. Nada. Net. Nothing. No relationship. Sort of like, you know, Al-Qaeda and Iraq. No relationship. Nonetheless, Ann Elhaus had been going on and on and on. And so instapundit.com, they called her on it, that she didn't fact check it. She says, frankly, I haven't tracked down the exact role of Jamie Gorelick as one of the government lawyers who played a role. In other words, you know, I don't do my fact-checking, right? She says, I didn't fact-check that either. And then the National Review's, John Poderts, or however he pronounces it. Poderts, whatever. He says, okay, the crazies got me. They pointed out, you know, that the whole Able Danger thing, that he'd been lying about it, and, you know, Jamie Gorelick. So he finally sort of admits that he was wrong, but not quite. And he calls the leftoid robots, right? Can't understand it. Glenn Reynolds, the guy who runs Instant Pundit, the most popular conservative blog, has responded to your emails demanding you correct the record. Essentially, his position, he's under no obligation to tell his readers the truth because he didn't write the post. Aha. Uh-huh. Yes. These all from thinkprogress.org, by the way. Remarkable. Thanks for being with us today. We'll see you tomorrow. Same time, same place.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.